Good evening and welcome to the Amsterdam. I'm Steve Seal, co-host of the morning show on The Current from Minnesota Public Radio. And it is so nice to see a great turnout here tonight for Policy and a Pint. This is our first show we've ever done at the Amsterdam. So big ups to the folks here at the Amsterdam for hosting us. We appreciate it. Yeah, let's hear it.
Although they need Guinness on tap, that's all I can say.
What? They don't have Guinness on tap? No. So this is our first program of our 2014-2015 season, and we've been doing these for 9 years in our partnership with the Citizens League. We are so proud to have this relationship with the Citizens League, a fantastic community organization that helps us all be more invested in our democracy. And we want to encourage you to check out the Citizens League and what they do. Follow them online. There are folks who are in Citizens League t-shirts around here where you can go to them and learn more about them and sign up to follow them on social media and whatnot and see what they're all about. And ideally, get involved if you like what you see. It's a nonpartisan organization, really just about fostering involvement in democracy. You're also going to see some folks in NPR shirts who are, they have tablets, I guess, and you can go to them and sign up for our political blog, our elections blog. You can find out, keep up to date at all times about what's going on in the election as things get closer and closer to election day, and get what NPR has to offer on that. And also, you could become a Minnesota Public Radio member, too, here tonight. Yeah. Now, I won't hit that home too hard, but because you're going to hear it plenty starting tomorrow, because tomorrow the membership drive starts. But, look, it's the only reason we can do this kind of stuff. So thank you for supporting public radio. We very much appreciate it. And, yeah, you'll hear it plenty tomorrow. But we do thank you for your membership support. Members here? Yay! Ho! Hot dog. Thank you very much. Finally, one thanks that we're excited that this, for the second year in a row, we have Target Corporation on board as our corporate sponsor, and we thank them very much for sponsoring a Policy and a Pint. So, it's election season. We have a treat for you tonight. We're just, starting to see the messages of the current campaign season really gear up in earnest all around us, and particularly in the form of campaign ads. And we wanted to take a closer look tonight at how the political message gets made. Now, they say that it's not terribly pleasant to find out how the sausage gets made. Well, politics is a business that's probably just as ugly as sausage making, if not uglier, I suppose. But taking a look behind the spin tonight, as our show is called, our aim is to make you a more informed voter by getting some insight into why the candidates' messages get crafted in the way that they do, and just exactly how your strings are being pulled when you hear what you hear. Here on stage with me are a couple of gentlemen who know an awful lot about how the message gets made. These are the evil geniuses behind the spin. Now, I was told we checked handbags, backpacks tonight for tomatoes, for projectiles, for anything that could be pelted at them. I'm up here too. They're very nice fellows, so be kind to them tonight. As long as there has been politics, there's been spin. As long as there, you could probably say, as long as there has been the English language, as long as there has been written or spoken language, there has been spin, because all communication is made up of what you leave in, what you take out, what you emphasize, and what you make up. But for politics, there's always been spin there, and what we want to find out tonight, as I said, is how the message gets created, who creates it, how do they come up with this, who decides, what they say, what they're going to emphasize. So, our guests tonight, and by the way, I'm sure we're going to talk an awful lot about money tonight as well, and how it ties into the entire process of campaign ads in particular. And we've got some really cool ads from over the years. We're going to go back over several decades here and look at examples of political ads tonight, too. Colin Sheehan currently practices in the field of state government affairs at the law firm of Lockridge Grindall Nowen. He represents clients before the Minnesota legislature on a variety of commerce, housing, education, and transportation issues. Cullen served as chief of staff to the Minnesota Senate Republican caucus and was instrumental in leading them to their first majority in 38 years. And in addition, he served as the senior advisor to United States Senator Norm Coleman and was Coleman's campaign manager in one of the most expensive and closest Senate races in Minnesota history. You get one guess which one that was. Cullen was the Midwest Regional Political Director for the Republican National Committee as well and served as the Executive Director of the Republican Party of Iowa. And he has also served in senior roles on numerous U.S. senatorial, congressional, and gubernatorial campaigns. So please welcome Cullen Sheehan. Mike Erlandson is a principal at Aurora Strategic Advisors, a public affairs, government relations, and communications firm. He served as chief of staff to U.S. Congressman Martin Szabo from 1993 to 2006. Mike ran for Congress in 2006, finishing second in a multi-candidate primary. He has appeared on a number of local television and radio shows as a commentator and analyst and on national television and radio shows, including The Today Show, Hardball, ABC's This Week with George Stephanopoulos. Did I mention that you were the chair? I didn't. I didn't mention that you were chair of the State Democratic Party. That didn't make it into my my bio here for some reason. These are like an early copy of my notes. What years were you chair of the State DFL?
99 to 2006.
And that's a good span of time.
Plenty of scars to show for
it. All right. Please welcome Mike Erlandson. Do we have any folks who have been to a Policy in a Pint before here tonight? Cool. Wow. Rocking the Policy in a Pint. Awesome. That is the first time I've ever heard one of those at these things. Well, that's awesome. All right, so this is how it works.
Clearly the policy part talking there.
That's what it is, not the pint at all. All right, so for those of you who haven't been, this is how it works. I will interview our gracious guests here for the first half of the show, or a little less, and then for the remainder of the hour, come on out and have the mic and take your questions. Please be thinking of your questions. Often they sort of tend to bunch up at the end. And so we want to make sure we get to as many questions here tonight as we can. The only rule is that I hold the microphone. Please do not try to grab it from me. And no speechifying, please. If your question turns into a speech, you'll probably get a few seconds before the mic gets pulled away. That's pretty much it. So let's kick it off here. So once upon a time, there was just the candidate. And the politician alone, right? And then there was the candidate and his group of advisors. How long have there been professional message managers? Can we sort of trace the origin of the specific job of the person who actually said to the candidate, you don't want to say that, say this, and the politician listened to him or her?
We probably could get out Wikipedia and find out the real answer to that question. But, you know, I mean, the reality is it's escalated year after year after year. And I think probably in the late 80s, early 90s, we started to see much more professional campaigns. And that came along as a result of the massive amount of money that started to come into campaigns at that particular time. And there was a switch in the 90s that's really been kind of exclamation pointed, I think, in the last 4 to 6 years, which is all of the independent money, which massively dwarfs the money spent by the campaigns and the candidates themselves. And so that has a lot, that has meant that there's not just the people helping the candidates along in their campaigns, to your question, Steve, but also the multitudes of people that are financed to parachute into a state or a congressional district or the legislative districts to sort of make a difference. And maybe never legally be able to even talk to the campaigns or the candidates themselves. It's sort of a separate subject, but, you know, I think a lot of it has to do with as more and more money has become involved in politics, it's really changed the whole beast.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, I think there's always been advisors, whether they're friends or co-workers, going back to the very first presidential elections. But I think you saw a dramatic shift with the advent of television ads, and I think that really exploded in the 80s and into the 90s. And now with outside groups, post McCain-Feingold, it's a consultant's dream to run one of these organizations because you don't have to deal with the candidates themselves or the candidates' better halves. You get to sit in a dark room. Nobody knows who you are, and you get to spend money trying to influence elections. So I think it has, over the course of the past 20 to 30 years, really exploded.
So you mentioned McCain-Feingold. I imagine there are a number of laws, court decisions, things like that, that are kind of key in the evolution of money and how money can be collected and then funneled to campaigns or groups or whatnot. Can you remind those of us, and me too, because I can never remember exactly what McCain-Feingold was?
Well,
John McCain, Russ Feingold had a bill.
Yeah, Mike lived in the middle of it. So it basically banned what they called soft money, and in my opinion, neutered state parties. Because they were spending what they called, soft money, which was virtually close to unlimited contributions. It wasn't really unlimited, but and in essence, it fixed the system. It cleaned up politics because now instead of $200 or $300 million presidential campaigns, we have $2 billion presidential campaigns. So it's been very effective.
Yeah, right, hasn't it? Okay, so then the next question is what changed that? I mean, before we even get to Citizens United, which is the big court decision within the past, 10 years? How many years ago really was that? People are like saying it out there. I can't hear them, but...
Just a
couple years ago. Yeah. Was it that recently?
And I mean...
I was going to just say, the money has started to trickle into politics for a long time. And it's just, I think we're just seeing more of it. Because politics has become big business. There probably isn't a bigger business to some degree in our country today. I mean, if you're a retailer, if you're Target, right, other than your customers having an impact on that particular business, the government is the next biggest entity that can, shut you down tomorrow. I worked for a food company for a long time. You fail a food safety test in the wrong place at the wrong time, the government shuts you down. Now, you could argue they should shut you down in that case. I'm not saying that they shouldn't, but as a result of this, everybody is getting involved in the influence game. We saw the lobbying change in our country, both here in Minnesota and the national level, along the same time. I mean, now there's something like 187 lobbyists for every one member of United States Congress, and I'm probably underestimating that at this point in time. The nature of the beast, right? And so politics has become big money, influencing elected officials has become big money, and then the courts have put the exclamation point on this over the last several years. And so, the Minnesota Senate race, for example, probably the governor's race too, I'm guessing there will 80% more will be spent by the outside groups than will be spent by the candidates themselves. So, if Cullen and I are running against each other, and this is sort of begs another question, right? And I'm telling everybody he's the biggest jerk in the world, and he's telling everybody I'm the biggest jerk in the world. At least the people watching the television commercials can say, that's who's calling each other a jerk, right? Versus, the citizens for an independent beer are calling Cullen a jerk or me a nice guy or vice versa, right? And nobody knows who they are, and they don't know where the money comes from. There are some people that will make huge contributions, like the Koch brothers, who will stand behind their money and admit to it. But I think there's a lot of people that don't want people to know they're making these contributions. And if they had to, which I think we should require disclosure, I think that would change the dynamics and the nature of this business. But we're kind of digressing away from...
This all ties in and everything, but I want to try to cover as much as I can in sort of the overall here before we look at a few ads and get to some questions. So I read something recently that kind of said, you shouldn't worry so much about the amount of money. Everybody laments the amount of money that is spent on politics, and that's because of the ad buys, television ads in particular. Because in the end, it really does, these ads really don't move the needle that much. You've got your voters who are pretty much decided on this side, pretty much decided on that side, and it really doesn't make that much difference. But I mean, it still seems to me to be a concern that we've got all this just reams of money that is being spent on, it's essentially being spent on undecideds, right? I mean, is that really what it comes down to, on swing voters? By the time we get to the general.
Yeah, I mean, they're
because we're not really running ads for primaries, essentially.
Yeah, that's the name of the game. I mean, there's going to be 30 or 40% Republican, 30 or 40% Democrat. You know, it fluctuates, you know, in small margins. But, you know, you're fighting for those independent or undecided voters. And unfortunately, it costs money. I mean, I think the biggest thing voters have to accept, and I don't know if we ever will, is that, you know, there's always going to be money in politics. It's just a reality. And I think, you know, creating a campaign finance system that's, you know, like the IRS, it's just unmanageable. Nobody knows the rules and it doesn't work. There should just be full disclosure and let people give money. If you write a $100,000 check, the public has to know about it within 24 hours. But, you know, television ads, you know, are still king. It's changing, you know, slowly over time. But if you look at a candidate who's never run for office, you know, Mike McFadden is a good example. If you look at a Star Tribune poll in 2013, his name ID was probably 2%. The last Star Tribune poll, it was 85%. And that's, you know, solely because he's started to run, television ads. Yes, he's traveling the state. Candidates all do. They do earned media. But, you know, then you're just picking at the margin. So, unfortunately, you know, you have to spend and raise a lot of money because media is expensive.
Right, exactly. All right, so we could sort of spend the whole hour on money itself, and I don't want to because I want to get to the message and how messages get crafted in what we used to call the smoke-filled rooms. I don't know if it's the gummy bear-filled rooms now, but or whatever, you know. There's not so much smoking going on perhaps anymore, but so how do you come up with message when you decide that, I'll give you an example. 2002, it was the election that late Paul Wellstone ran in when he died and was replaced during those last few weeks by Vice President Mondale. I remember watching the ads for the Democrats, and there was a single message. This was the time when we were on edge after 9/11. There was so much angst on the liberal side or the Democratic side about saber rattling. Are we going to be going into war in Iraq? And we don't, you know, is that so much of a good idea? But this was not a message that was getting touched in the election. I remember specifically Senator Wellstone saying, this election is about prescription drugs. And it was fascinating to me because I thought, and he was saying this, and all the candidates across the board on the Democratic side were saying this single message when I would think a lot of people thought to themselves, really? Is that what they're going to go campaigning into? In this election, when it's not necessarily what's on the mind of the Democratic voters? Well, there was a reason that it was decided that that was the campaign message, and I want to find out how this pattern is repeated over and over again. Who decides what the message is?
Well, I mean, I think that everybody probably knows the answer to this question to some degree, but I mean, you know, campaigns today, at least the big ones, are very sophisticated, and they also are, which means there's lots of pollsters sitting around in the back room that spend, you know, again, tens of thousands of dollars fine-tuning who we're going to try to target with what particular message. Sometimes it's a broad message, and sometimes it's a very strategic and targeted message. One of the ads we're going to play here maybe a little bit later called Coach, which is a McFadden ad, is a very targeted ad, even though it has a general appeal, I think, to the broader audience. But again, to Cullen's point earlier, you know, there's maybe 30% of the electorate up for grabs. I would argue that there's probably only 15, 16% up for grabs in the Senate race right now, and McFadden has to get 13 of it in order to win the election, right? So they have to be a little bit more risky with their messages and maybe have to be a little bit more risky with the attacks once we get there. But message development is, you know, based on obviously a set of core values. It often lines up with the political party and some core set of beliefs there. And then it's very strategic polling and research groups and a variety of other things that come into play. Very little of it is gut when it comes to an election that can ultimately be won in the margins, as our statewide races usually are. You know, a safe congressional district, that's a different story.
Yeah, I would. I mean, I think when you're thinking about messaging in a campaign, I think the Atwaters and the Carvilles are few and far between. They're characters and they're successful, but I think most, you know, what voters don't realize is while you guys are pulling your hair out saying, why are they doing this, you know, running negative ads, this is awful, you know, or I love it, the campaigns are sitting, there's, you know, a bunch of people sitting in multiple campaign offices tonight pulling their hair out saying, what do the voters want? You know, what's going to move the needle? And it really is, you know, it's gotten to be more of a science, just like everything in life, Major League Baseball, Moneyball, you know, from voter targeting to, you know, demographics and how you pick apart, you know, what ads you're running and where. So, I mean, you do a poll, you find out what moves the needle, and you try and hone in on that as much as you can. But it's not really mad science or evil geniuses in the back saying we're going to pound them today because, I mean, there's a method behind it, and they're a lot of times frustrated because they don't know what you guys are going to react to.
And I think what's fascinating about that is that you're talking about voters being frustrated by a particular thing or wanting to hear a particular thing. And part of what has evolved to be part of the frustration, it would seem to me, is being this particular process of parsing the message, creating this situation where you hear ads that have been, we hear entire messages, not just ads, but speeches, debate liners, zingers that have been scripted within an inch of their life, and everybody, well, most people kind of know it.
Yeah.
Well, and sometimes people switch. I mean, I was involved in, or I was at least asked my opinion one time in a race. People may remember Ann Winia was running for the United States Senate against Rod Grams, whenever that was. She was 17 points ahead with about 14 days to go in the campaign. And it had been a brutal negative campaign where the Winia campaign was beating the living daylights out of Rod Grams, and it was working, right? She was way ahead. And a group of people were sitting around in a room, and the candidate, a wonderful person, Ann, said, well, you know, as long as we're so far ahead, I think I would like to change strategy, and I'd like to go to Washington on a positive note. And the positive note, they decided to switch the strategy and stop picking on Rod Grams, and they put her face up on television with a positive message, sort of introducing herself to Minnesotans. And Minnesotans looked at the television, unfortunately, and said, oh, that's who's running against Rod Grams, even though they did not like Rod Grams. And in the final 2 weeks of that campaign, she went from 17 points ahead to losing by like maybe 10 or something.
Because she wasn't telegenic? Is that what you're saying?
Well, I mean, I think it was a combination of maybe not being so telegenic, but it was also a combination of they had a great strategy and a great campaign, and they had it mapped out to the end, and they were ahead, and they switched. It's one thing to switch your campaign if you're down by 14 points or 17 points, but when you're up, it's sort of like if you're in a horse race, right, and you're 7 lengths ahead, do you get off the horse and get on a different one? I think maybe you finish that baby off.
So, again, I'm wondering how...
But that was a candidate decision, which is sort of a troubling one. And, you know, there
these candidates should have... They have no
they
business
have no
making
business,
these decisions.
No opinions. It's a perfect
no
campaign.
Business. Yeah. Exactly.
Well, I think right. What my point was, that not that as much as, you know, as that, right?
Yeah, no. Yeah. If there just weren't the candidates... Now, you talked about polls and stuff. I mean, where do you actually get your information that you use? I had heard crazy things like, I was not aware that until somebody schooled me the other day that, and it was my producer, Jane, Karl Rove is essentially kind of, actually maybe it was Jan from the Citizens League too, I can't remember, but Karl Rove is essentially kind of the guy who is seen as the king of taking consumer information, not just polls, not just would you vote for this or, you know, what do you think about this particular issue, you know, a phone call that you get when you're at home at night, or not just polls from CBS or Wall Street Journal or something, but actually taking consumer information. What kind of car do you drive? Do you drive a Volvo? Do you eat Campbell's bean with bacon? Do you do, you know, this kind of stuff, and sort of dovetailing all that information with... you know, together, basically, yeah. To figure out what campaign strategy to use. That's insane. Is that for real?
Yeah, that's and it's not generally used in television, although that's changed now too. But I you know, it used to be you did targeting and it was, you know, geographic. You know, you'd take precinct reports from past elections and try and determine, you know, which areas had the most moderates or which were the most conservative or the most liberal. And Karl Rove and Ken Melman, after reading the book Moneyball, I think, or as a part of that process, sort of determined, you know, after the 2000 election into 2004, they started testing things and realized that, you know, consumer data is also an indicator of, you know, a person's, you know, political habits. So if you read Hunter magazine, you're likely a gun owner and you're probably more likely to vote Republican. So they started buying all this consumer data and merging it in with their lists, you know, overlaying it, and, you know, they would mail people or phone people with specific messages based off of that. And it obviously worked. The president got reelected in 2004, and it helped in midterm elections. But the Obama campaign over the course of the past 8 years has taken that and gone gangbusters. And, you know, Republicans are catching up, but they've, you know, were caught flat-footed. They were kind of stuck in the micro-targeting days and have missed this whole new world where, I mean, I've read articles about, you know, how the Obama campaign is literally sending multiple emails to Small Universe to test, you know, what color font works. And
this is where we are now.
It's where you are. Yeah. And it's so what you're doing is you have the capability now to dwindle, you know, what was a universe of a precinct where you were trying to determine where an independent lived in a specific household. But, you know, now, what is their particular habit going to be? What kind of candidate do they like? What is their main issue that's going to push them? So it's really, I mean, it's become a science.
And one of the first campaigns to actually do this effectively, way before there was a lot of computer-driven and text messages and all these ways, was actually this bald governor we had not so long ago, Jesse Ventura, right? And Cullen mentioned the Hunting and Gun magazine, but this campaign very strategically had almost no money, and I think I had the story at the Times that they spent the $6,000 or $8,000 that they had buying all of the Minnesota addresses for Hunting and Guns magazine, for Fishing magazine, for Bullets magazine, and a variety, you know, wrestling magazine, and then they just
Bullets magazine.
There's got to be a Bullets magazine. But you get the point, right? And so, and they mailed them all a bumper sticker and an envelope. Nothing more, right? But what happened overnight in Minnesota was suddenly you had 10,000 Chevy trucks and F-150s with a Jesse Ventura bumper sticker on the back of it, and they got back, you know, the seed money for their campaign that allowed them to do a couple commercials, and the rest of it sort of became a little bit of history. Yeah. So, but that was a very early micro-targeting.
All right, I want to watch some ads, and then we're going to take some questions.
Great.
So I think we should start with the what is, I think, the oldest ad that we have here, because it represents, from what I understand, kind of a sea change. I don't think of this as being the most famous political ad. I think of the most famous one being the girl pulling the petals off the daisy for LBJ and the bomb going off. But that was only aired once. This one was aired many, many times and actually made a magnificent difference and really kind of changed the way campaign ads are. So let's look at this one.
There is a bear in the woods. For some people, the bear is easy to see. Others don't see it at all. Some people say the bear is tame. Others say it's vicious and dangerous. Since no one can really be sure who's right, isn't it smart to be as strong as the bear? If there is a bear.
If there is a bear.
Prepared for peace.
Right, prepared for peace.
You know, I think I might have picked this ad originally. I mean, I think it's the most effective political ad that was ever done, really, right? You know, I mean, at the time, you had the sitting governor of California who had a, you know, wasn't really on the national radar screen. And the biggest thing they were trying to combat, that he would be weak on national security and national defense. And, of course, obviously the sitting president was having his own troubles at that same time with a lot of, you know, international issues. But this really changed, this sort of introduced Ronald Reagan. It put a stamp on The conflict at that time. It's good to see that this room is at least young enough that maybe some people don't remember who the bear was,
yeah.
Right?
Is anybody not sure who the bear was in this room? The bear was the Soviet Union. That's right. There used to be this thing called the Soviet Union. So this was really effective, huh? And how did they? My question is: so it was effective, and they knew what the mission was that they had to do. They had to change people's perceptions on Reagan's, strength or weakness or whatnot. He was perceived as not being strong enough. How did they know this was going to be the message that was going to work? Or did maybe they just didn't? That's just the question.
Well, I think they went at his weaknesses and his pitching what those perceived weaknesses into a real strength. I think one of the things that's also interesting about this ad, and we still don't do very much of this today, is it was an ad that was produced by Hollywood, right? It was, even though this particular copy isn't a very good copy because of how old it is, it was a first-rate done, television ad at that time. And one of the things that I'm always amazed by is that, Target again, for example, or Coca-Cola.
Target has nothing to do with any of this. Leave them out of it. We appreciate their involvement very much.
Right. I think this would be positive. We would not dream of spending, $4,000 on a political ad or $10,000, which is what is spent today and a lot of times, and then $5 million showing it to people, paying to put it on television over and 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 over again, right? Yeah. So you get these really bad ads that we get clubbed over the head with versus a really good ad. I think that which this is, and we've seen some pretty good ones in Minnesota today, but we've gotten a lot of clubbing too.
And what I love about it is it highlights probably the number one debate that occurs in politics, and that is voters hate negative ads. Obviously, this ad is playing on fear. Elect me because I'll keep you safe. And the reality is that voters all hate negative ads, but they work. That's what people respond to. And there are bad negative ads, don't get me wrong. There are ads that are over the top that are ineffective. But what motivates people a lot of times, unfortunately, is fear or getting a negative impression about the other person running for office. And that's why it happens.
Where should we go from here? I'm kind of inclined to go to another negative ad.
We could do the hair.
The hair. Let's do that one. So that's the Mills. Is that the Mills Rich Guy one?
Yeah.
The Mills Rich Guy.
DCCC.
Oh, I'm sorry. DCCC ad. Mills DCCC hair.
Second to the last there one on the list.
Can you see that one, Jane? Okay.
I could just do the ad for you.
You've probably seen this one.
None of us have the right hair. This is
currently running. You see it?
Yeah. Folks saying that the wealthy are not paying their fair share. 2%, the 1%, whatever percent you want, is personally offensive. Personally offensive.
That's not the right one, still a personally offensive ad, don't you?
Stuart Mills inherited his millions and got a family job paying $560,000 a year. Now Stuart Mills is against raising the minimum wage, but wants another tax break for the wealthy because paying his fair share is
personally offensive.
Stuart Mills is just out of touch. House Majority PACs responsible for the content of this ad.
What was that again? Who was responsible for the content of the ad?
Yeah, the House Majority PAC, so that's it.
Okay, so let's actually use that as a touching off point, because this is an example of an ad that was created not by a candidate's team, but by another organization, which was nevertheless, not some outside group. This is not a Swift Boat Veterans for Truth kind of ad. This is still within, the message loop. So talk about that a little bit. I mean, the different kinds of ads. We actually have ads that are created by the candidate.
Yep.
Right? What are the sort of different kinds of ads that we have? We have that, then we have the
party
ads.
Yeah, the party ads.
Or is there really only one kind
outside
of party?
Groups.
Okay. Yeah. And then, like I said, Swift Boat. So, when something comes along that is a surprise, that is an outside group like Swift Boat, how much can that potentially throw off a campaign and get, in George W. Bush's case, it certainly worked for him. Mm-hmm. What would be an example of how often does it happen when an outside group comes comes in with a message of something they really want to drive home and totally screws up the message for the candidate that this party, this group ostensibly thinks it's going to benefit. Does that ever happen?
Yeah, I mean, I think campaigns, actually, you know, it's a double-edged sword. I don't think you can win a statewide race or presidential race without outside help. But you also can't coordinate or tell them what to do, so you're sitting in the room much like wondering what voters are going to do. You're sitting there going, okay, what's this, you know, what are they going to do? And I'd say, you know, 50% of the time you're scratching your head and, I you know, the ads aren't necessarily, you know, debilitating, but they're kind of saying, well, that's not the message that we're seeing in our polls. Why did they attack that or go after that?
Well, in the ad that we haven't played yet, you know, some I think when you're running one of these ads, if you can get the campaign or the candidate to respond, you know it's at least getting under their skin a little bit, right? And so I don't know that we'll play this one, but there was, some of you may remember, at one point in time, Senator Wellstone's campaign had this really, really long ad. I think it lasted...
Yeah, we should watch it because we have it.
Can
you get that
okay.
one, Jane? Okay. This one is a classic. Many of you will remember.
When I decided to run for Senate, there was one thing I was looking forward to. So, as it turns out, were a lot of you.
Well, I expect that there will be some debates.
I'd love to see you debate with him.
Well, I think there should be debates, yeah.
Some people have more money than others to play with, and where if you debate, you're kind of standing there without money.
Getting a hold of the person I had to debate, however, proved easier said than done.
Is Rudy Boschwitz here?
No, he's not.
You don't want me to go in?
No, we don't like strangers walking around.
First, I tried his campaign headquarters.
Then let me give you my home phone number, too, okay?
Sure. I'll make sure that he gets this, and we'll get back to you.
What do you think? Do you think we should have debates around the state? So that people can see.
I'll get the message to him.
What do you think?
Glad to meet you.
No, but about these debates.
Thanks for coming down.
Okay.
Make sure he gets your message.
Okay, all right. I'll see you all.
Nice car. Then I tried his office.
Is he here?
He is not here. He is returning from Milwaukee.
No luck.
I'll write my home phone.
Sure.
Is this your pen?
I'm not sure. Probably not.
Looks like a nice one. Well, I don't have a lot of money, so I'll keep this one for our campaign.
That will be fine.
I tried everything. I mean everything.
Rudy Boschwitz here.
No, not today.
Did Rudy Boschwitz call? Did anybody get a call from him?
No.
Well, if he calls everybody, let me know. Hey, you guys?
Okay, well, maybe I can find him somewhere then. Thank you very much. Okay, bye-bye.
They say he's in the cities. I don't know where he is. He's not in Minneapolis. They say he's campaigning. Then I go to St. Paul. They say he's in Milwaukee.
Rest assured there will be debates on the key issues of this campaign. Look for upcoming dates and places. And in the meantime, if you see a silver-haired gentleman in a plaid shirt, mention I'm looking for him.
Yes, information, do you have the telephone number of a Rudy Boschwitz, please, in Plymouth?
Yep. Now, that ad ran once as well, right? I didn't know that.
It ran one time for on paid television, right, which is all they really had the money to run it. But what's powerful about that is it got so much attention from the media, right? So on the 5 o'clock, the 6 o'clock, the 10 o'clock news, for the next several days, they kept playing this ad and analyzing the ad and taking the ad apart and on and on and on and on. So where they probably back in that time, it probably cost $5,000 or if to run that ad the one time. And they got, you know, $500,000 worth of free media time, which today would be millions of dollars. And so, and that was really the target. It was this, again, this ad happened to be done by somebody that was a professional ad person. In other words, somebody that went to ad training school instead of just won a couple of campaigns and decided they would make political ads. That's a different conversation, but we see a lot of that today. And they took a little bit of a risk. It's sort of interesting because today we're having a different sort of debate about debates, and we have one of the McFadden ads in the reel here as well. But, you know, this ad really turned the campaign for Senator Wellstone, and one of the things that I was going to say just before we played it, a lot of that was because it really got under Senator Boschwitz's skin. And after all of the time that it was spent being debated on the news, he decided to respond with a personal letter to some of his supporters that was, you know, sort of so offensive to his supporters that it ultimately really turned them off and shift the campaign, and that letter became public. I think it was something along the lines of, I'm a better Jew than the other guy. And suddenly, again, it was a candidate making a mistake that there was just no recovering from.
I've gone way long here, and so I want to get as many questions as we can here. I understand there's also a show happening here later tonight, so we can't really go longer, which sucks. But we should probably, I just want to watch the slickest one that I'm aware of on here, which is the Jesse Ventura ad. So can we pull that one up? This one also, this is utterly masterful to me, and it's kind of hard for me to describe why, but let's watch it.
New from the Reform Party. Yeah! It's the new Jesse Ventura action figure. You can make Jesse battle special interest groups.
I don't want your stupid money.
And party politics.
We politicians have powers the average man can't comprehend.
You can also make Jesse lower taxes, improve public education, and fight for the things Minnesotans really care about.
This bill wastes taxpayer money. Read, trust it.
Don't waste your vote on politics as usual. Vote Reform Party candidate Jesse Ventura for governor.
That's a masterpiece. I mean, and what's amazing about that to me is that that's like appealing to people with a great sense of humor. It's like it just like speaks to so many people at once, it seems to me.
Same guy who did the Wellstone ad.
Are you serious?
Yeah, Bill Hilsman is the guy that did both ads. So,
all right. Let's just start with questions. Yeah, all right, we'll start with this one up here.
I literally wanted to ask, how much does Bill Hilsman have to do in that campaign and in the Wellstone campaign in setting up those issues? Is he simply taking information from the campaign and making an ad, or is he actually driving the bus, as it were?
Well, I don't think any one person ever really drives the bus, but you know, there's no question that Hilsman's ads really made the difference for Wellstone's first campaign, and certainly he was one of the masterminds around Ventura's campaign. And you know, there was another guy in Minnesota, Dean Barkley, who probably had a lot of influence on Minnesota politics at the time because he, I think, went to the Republican Party wanting to run for the state legislature. They told him, no, thank you, we're not interested. A couple months later, they didn't have anybody to run against Jerry Sikorsky, so they called up this guy, Dean Barkley, and said, hey, would you run again? You know, they were just trying to get somebody on the ballot. And then Jerry Sikorsky ended up getting involved in what was called a scandal at the time around the House Bank. Dean Barkley becomes the congressperson, and then 2 years later, he decides he's going to run for the United States Senate. He takes enough votes from, who won that Senate race? No, I forget.
Which one?
Dean Barkley. Well, he took enough votes from the Democratic candidate, anyway, that elected Rod Grams. That's right. Rod Grams elected Rod Grams to the House, then he elected Rod Grams to the United States Senate, and then Dean Barkley convinced Jesse Ventura to run for governor. Right. So if you look at the 90s, there's no individual probably had more impact on Minnesota politics than Dean Barkley, and most people don't know who he is. Right.
I mean, to your point, though, I think, campaigns have 3, 4, 5, 6, I'd say unsuccessful ones have 10 or 20, who provide input, and, you know, Bill Hilsman and others would be a part of that conversation. They're all looking at the same thing, and then a creative, you know, your creative person then drafts scripts. Everybody looks at them, they make some changes, and then they go off and do their thing, and, you know, in your inbox you have an ad, and hopefully you like it.
We can go a little over tonight, maybe 10 or 15 past if we need to. Next question.
Hi. Steve touched on this question earlier, but it's about polling, and it's something I've been wondering for quite a while because no one answers their phone when they don't recognize the number. So where, even my 80-year-old mother finally got caller ID. Like, where do you get your polling numbers from?
It is more difficult, but they just keep calling and calling and calling and calling is the reality of that. So, and some people, you know, question whether or not you get valid data anymore. But I think if you see strategically how campaigns continue to target specific groups of people that, you know, when you look back in the rearview mirror, turn out to be the actual undecideds. And so, you know, McFadden right now, his ads, if you look at them, we may not have time for them tonight, but they're very targeted for men right now. So I had this conversation with my wife the other day. You know, most of his ads women find offensive, right? Well, they're not targeting them. They've sort of given up on that group of people. That group of people, yeah.
That group of people. I didn't say this was going to be, any of this tonight was going to be encouraging for our democracy. Yeah. It was just going to be, or for, you know, like, the world, just that it was going to be informative, hopefully. All right. Did you want to?
No.
Colin, did you want to?
No, go ahead.
Okay.
Howdy. As the Independence Party endorsed candidate for Secretary of State, I'm doing what I need to do to be competitive in this race, but I'm very curious to know from an insider's perspective, you know, one of my biggest challenges is to unspin the messaging of people like you and people who are working in your roles now. So what do you think of the independents or third parties in the race? Do you love them, hate them, or just ignore them? Thanks.
It really... All right. The consultant answer is it really depends, because if the candidate is pulling votes from your opponent, you love them and you want them to be at debates, and that's a part of the strategy. Some candidates, you know, over the course of the past two decades here have, you know, fought to make sure that everybody was represented on stage, and other campaigns just want it to be the two because they're trying to highlight a key difference and to gain attention. I mean, I think the Independence Party's, you know, issue has been, you know, it doesn't matter if there's, you know, two parties or three parties or eight parties. It's you know, creating a base of support that is consistent. And that hasn't been the case. I mean, I think you get candidates and some people automatically say, well, I'm an independent or I hate both sides, so I'm going to vote for them. But as you've seen over the years, that group of people is, you know, 5%, 6%, sometimes as much as 18%. And if you get a guy like Jesse, it's enough to win an election. But it's really, really hard. And, you know, the Independence Party just has to continue to, you know, try and, again, build a grassroots base of support. And it's not an easy or a cheap thing to do.
And there's no way that Jesse could have created an ad like that, presumably, until he already had momentum, considerable momentum, right? Because that would have taken a lot of money to hire the gentleman who made that.
Well, I mean, the one thing about Bill is he makes some pretty cheap ads. I mean, he makes ads cheaply, not cheap ads, because we both witnessed here, they're very good ads. But and he did that, you know. And again, back to the bumper sticker story that I told, right? They did have some money, they had a lot of momentum, and they had a candidate that had a larger-than-life personality, right? Senator Wellstone was helped when he ran the first time as well, because he only stood 5 foot some inches tall, he had a larger than life personality and got a lot of attention. So that helps in politics.
Right.
The two-part question. The U.S. Senate candidate in Michigan hasn't done a public event in 7 days. Do you foresee a time when ads and press releases are the way campaigns are run? And second part, do lawn signs matter?
Uh-huh.
Wow. The first part of that answer is, I mean, I think you're seeing a strategy now from incumbents, particularly Democrat senators, to, you know, avoid public appearances, because you don't, why take hits when you don't have to? Certainly if you're ahead, I don't, you know, Republican or Democrat, you want to limit any vulnerability. And every time you go out in public and, you know, the candidate says something, it's a huge vulnerability, because, you know, since 1998, maybe even earlier than that, you have, you know, an opposition researcher with a camera in your face 24 hours a day. And so everything you say gets, you know, recorded and then totally misconstrued on an ad. So, yeah, I mean, I think if you have enough, you know, enough of an advantage and you're, you know, far enough ahead in the polls, you're going to do everything you can to avoid public appearances, unfortunately. The second part of the question.
Do lawn signs matter?
Lawn signs matter.
They make the candidate feel good. That's
the running joke in every campaign. And you need lawn signs because your supporters think that you're totally, you know, all hope is lost if they don't see any. But I've yet to see any evidence whatsoever that the candidate with more lawn signs wins the election. It does dramatically impact the candidate's mood, though.
Yeah. I mean, I think another part answered your question. Now a lot of campaigns, they don't want to not give somebody a lawn sign if they want a lawn sign, but they'd like to ask you to pay for them, right? So you can, that kind of speaks for itself, I think.
I have a special announcement. Would the owner of a Pontiac Vibe, I've never done this, actually, at a policy and a fine before, with the license plate 979NWJ, please go up to the front there it might, I don't know what's happening. I don't know if it blew up or if it's blocking traffic or what, but that's the car. So if that sounds like you, please go to the front.
Jan? Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And if you know your license plate, right. You get a free beer. Yeah.
All right, next question.
So I guess mine kind of builds on that last question. If, according to Colin, if sort of candidates are trying to avoid public appearances and we are sort of gravitating more towards ads, to what extent does that detract from the substantive debate around issues? And is that a concern? If we are concerned about ads detracting from public debate, should we maybe focus more on public appearances?
I don't think that's a new phenomenon. I think campaigns have, you know, if you're ahead, you don't want to do public appearances for the most part. You do as little as you possibly can, again, because you want to limit exposure, because you're being tracked 24 hours a day. So I actually think ads over time have become less impactful. Not a lot. TV is still king. Video is king. And that may be the case just in a different venue. It's not a new phenomenon. I think if you're ahead, you know, why do anything to risk losing?
Yeah, I mean, I pretty much agree with that. I mean, I don't think that it's not often that candidates completely go into hiding, as was pointed out, as it sort of seems in Michigan, right? They, you know, and if you're an incumbent, you know, you spend things trying, you know, if you're the governor, you try to play governor as often as you possibly can. If you're the senator, you play senator, right? As campaigns get much more contested, right? Or if an incumbent is behind, then he or she has to get out there, right? But for the most part, most campaigns have their candidates very busy. Most of the time, you know, whether that's shaking hands at the state fair or, you know, and of course we've spent probably more time talking about Senate races and governor's races than somebody running for the legislature who is every single night out there knocking on their neighbor's doors, you know, sort of retail politics. You know, if you want to run for the legislature, I encourage you. You can win one of these legislative seats by literally just being the person that knocks on the most doors, assuming you're not personally offensive. As we learned in the ad.
If you're unsightly.
Yeah.
Personally offensive. Open the door. All right.
Wait, this one last thing there. I think what you see, too, is, you know, candidates, they'll hide behind manufactured events. So, you know, if they rent a room and do a town hall style meeting, you know, then they can kick out who they want to kick out. And then the event's not recorded. And you're doing it in front of people who agree with 99% of what you're going to say.
But maybe not anymore.
Not seriously. Anymore.
I mean, because Mitt, 48%. I was just thinking about that because, you know, now
that was a big campaign blunder.
Exactly. And it really was potentially kind of a turning point because here we now have candidates. One would imagine learning from that and realizing they have to be on message from the moment their feet hit the floor out of bed in the morning.
Right.
Yeah. All right. Next question.
So I want to understand an analogy that I've heard both sides sort of throw out here, and this is the Moneyball analogy. So I've heard sort of both sides mention this, and I actually taught this morning. I teach strategy at Carlson School of Management. And my understanding of Moneyball is it's bang for your buck, but we're seeing bucks fly at a higher rate than ever before, which seems the antithesis of Moneyball. It just seems the intelligence is more advanced and costs more, but it's not really Moneyball, because if you look at what the Oakland A's did, which is the core of what your argument is, they spent considerably less money and less resources and less man hours to do this successful thing. So I'm not sure I really understand the parallel in Moneyball applying here when we're seeing record dollar amounts everywhere. Does that make sense?
Wow.
Yeah, I think it makes sense. And
no, that's an interesting question.
And there, I mean, in my personal opinion, there's too much money in politics today, but you know, if you're running for office, you can't sort of unilaterally disarm and spend less money just because you think you might have it more impactful in some way. But at the same time, you know, one of the reasons these last two ads that we watched that I picked them, right, or had a part of, we picked them together, but sort of put them into the mix here, right? Both the Wellstone ad and the Ventura ad. That was just one of, Jesse had the Thinker ad too, if you remember that particular ad, you know. They didn't have very much money. And one of my pet peeves in politics is, and I sort of alluded to it earlier, is that, you know, you wouldn't think, no business would spend a couple thousand dollars producing a television ad and then spend $1 million airing it, right? And we see that over and over and over and over again by political campaigns. I don't think that's necessarily the most effective. I'd rather spend $50,000 or $100,000, maybe not the millions they spend on a Super Bowl ad, but producing a really good ad, particularly to your point, if you've got less money, right? So you produce a really good ad or a really good baseball team, and then you use what enough get enough of it out there in the public domain that it catches fire and people start talking about it. And today, of course, the challenge is, can you get it to go viral on the internet, right? You know, the Wellstone ad probably would have gone, if we had the internet back then or whatever, Twitter and whatnot, it would have gone viral on those things. It would have even had a bigger impact.
Yeah, I mean, and there's two separate things here. One, campaigns with a ton of money, obviously, they're like the New York Yankees, and they can, you know, they can do a lot more, and they can spend more, you know, frivolously. And you're still going to see that in campaigns. I think the Moneyball reference is more about, you know, as you take a catcher and you make him a first baseman because that didn't matter. What mattered was he got on base over, he hit 300 and got on base. In a campaign, I think what Rove and Melman were trying to accomplish was after the 2000 election, it was about compassionate conservatism. It was just television ads. And that's what the 80s and 90s were, just television ads. And you're just tossing up tons of money and hoping that, you know, you're seen as the better candidate. And what they tried to do was refine it and say, well, you know, why can't we look at this more analytically? Why can't we look at campaigns like, you know, like the Oakland A's viewed baseball players? It wasn't just sizing them up as scouts say, hey, look, they're the, you know, he's the, got the perfect build. He can probably hit home runs and hope that he did, and he didn't. It was looking at statistical information, taking consumer data and overlaying it over voter data and saying, you know, if we do this, we might more narrowly be able to, you know, hone down our mail universe and spend more money doing mail or spend more money doing email or other things like that and not just spend, you know, $500 million on television alone.
You still got to be a good candidate. I mean,
that's
we've seen
one.
Plenty of, you know, people spend a lot of money, some very wealthy candidates. I think the Al Checky, for example, who was the head of Northwest Airlines back when we called it Northwest Airlines, he went to California. He spent something like $45 million, which was a record at the time in the state of California, to finish third or fourth place, right? So ultimately, you still have to put – you have to have a message that it grabs on to people. You have to target the right people. You can't just buy an election, for lack of a better way to put it. Yep.
Not yet. Yeah, but, you know, you raise an interesting point, which is, you know, when we talk about social media and how the Obama campaign really presided over kind of a new phase in elections on that and really mastered it, that suggests that, and also, you know, talking about sending out things where just the color of fonts are being tested, we're going to be talking about potentially, rather than just living in an age where it's the fine-tuning of message plus bombardment with ads, it's really coming down to like an increasingly granular fine-tuning of message. When social media is involved, it's just, one can only imagine the staggering amounts of research and data and whatnot that could go into crafting a message, crafting, symbolism, all this stuff, you know? Yes. All right.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, you know, and I would just say, yeah, and you know, we didn't touch on this at all, but you know, what every campaign has to do too is drag their people to the polls, right? You know, so we are a couple of weeks away now, and actually, it started already to some degree because I've already voted if you want, right? Because of early voting now in Minnesota and a lot of other places. But, you know, campaigns will work very hard, political parties will work very hard to get their people, make sure their people show up and vote. That's another whole round of telephone calls that people won't answer, but listen to those messages, you know, please right. Remember to vote. And in Minnesota, I think one of the reasons we have some of these sort of things like the stickers on the back of trucks or whatever take place a little bit earlier, or campaigns, because we have a 70% voter turnout, right? Most states, it's less than 50%, right? When Bill Clinton ran for the president the first time, and it was all about getting the young people to vote, and that was an all-time record for people under the age of 25 voting in that election at the time. Does anybody have any idea what that percentage might have been? It was 11%, right? So 11% of the eligible voters. If Minnesota, I think it got to 14%. But so the power there being, if you can get a block of people out to vote, particularly a group of people that doesn't normally vote in elections, they make a big difference. President Obama got that group of people back out in massive numbers again when he ran for the first time. And it's been a challenge for the Democratic Party to get them back ever since.
I think we. I can take one more question, then we're going to wrap it up.
So you're talking.
I hold the mic. Sorry.
So you're talking about this. You said it's not rocket science, and there is this method for identifying sort of how people will vote and really how to craft messages to get them to do things. And I wonder if you can say a little more explicitly what that method is. And then I also imagine that there's like this. Sort of like very detailed matrix of if all of these criteria and these messages equals vote, and like where do those live? You know, like can I get my hands on those? Like who's got those? And so finally, three parts.
Three questions. Right, that's taking care of the show here. So.
If we can identify people's worst fears and their worst motivations and play into those so effectively. Can't this same system and these methods and these keys, this mysterious keys to making us do things through messaging, can't those also be used to communicate to our best selves? And couldn't you actually be making a sort of revolution in us being our best selves using these techniques? And so why are we not doing that?
All right. Now, where did we start? What was our first one? Before we got to the secret vault star chamber where the matrices live, what was the first one? I'm sorry. I'm just trying to be myself.
I'm not sure. I completely understood the last part of the question. But one of the things that I've noticed for the first time outside of the world of political advertising over the course of the last maybe 4 or 5 years is you actually see companies starting to do some negative advertising against other companies, right? They tend to do it in a positive way, right? You wouldn't be stupid enough to drive a Chevy when you could drive a Ford F-150, right? And they kind of do these comparisons. But I think some of that is, as we've seen so much more of that sort of negative attack in politics, we're starting to see a little bit of it, I think, in the commercial sector. That's a little bit of a one-off, but I think, again, it's the power of sort of sometimes these negative ads can work when most of the time there's very few companies that would ever take the risk of their brand being negative towards another brand, even if they happen to be number one in a particular marketplace.
Yeah, and I think defining negative is really difficult. I mean, if you're a challenger candidate, you know, regardless of your party, how are you going to win an election when you both stand up there and say, aren't we both wonderful people? What's the point of throwing out the guy in the office then? Just because he's from a different party. I mean, I think the only way that'll ever change is if voters demand it. And I don't know. It hasn't happened, because what's been most effective is a candidate getting up and saying, vote for me because he might be a nice person, but he's done X, Y, and Z wrong. And that's why you should toss him out of office. And I think that's just a reality that's difficult to change. I think the second part of your question is, I don't think anything is secret. You know, national parties and outside groups spend millions and millions of dollars collecting this data. They purchase it. They have volunteers making phone calls or going door to door to gather it. And over years, lists or voter files get built up, and you have, you know, evil geniuses sitting behind computers who are a lot smarter than I'll ever be, you know, sort of analyzing it and making determinations. But I would say campaigns are becoming more rocket science.
Yeah, that's really, I think, was the essence of her question. Yeah, it's not so much, is there a secret vault, but, like, how much are we talking about just actuarial tables, you know, where there's just, like, if these 25 things happen meets these other 100 things, what will be the outcome?
Well, I would just say, too, that, you know, despite of all of the talk about not letting our information be shared, and all, I'm not proposing that, but at the same time, most people are more than willing to share lots of information about themselves, mm-hmm. right? In very, very, very public places, Answering questions with the people that do pick up the phone, the Obama campaign that Cullen referenced, when they would do it in an event and they'd get these tens of thousands of people to show up, one of the first things they asked people to do was text them that they were there,
yep.
Right? And so overnight, they built this massive database of people across the country that they could go back and learn more about. But again, every time he walked into a door, they could instantaneously text everybody in this particular zip code, show up at 5 o'clock at the New Amsterdam, and President or the candidate Obama will be there, and whoosh, they all came, right? So there's a lot of information in the public domain, and I, to some degree, to Cullen's point, it used to be much more difficult to find those people and target them. Today, there's just so much information available on all of us that we're willing to share.
Because we're happy to tweet it and post it on Facebook.
There you go. And just like data is, this is the data age when data is power for business, it is for politics as well. And don't think that the things that you're doing on Facebook and Twitter and my goodness, probably your location of where your iPhone is not information that's being used as well. One more question before you wrap up. Typically, how much power does the team have over the candidate?
One would say a good campaign with a good candidate, it'll be a team effort, right? I think the Ann Winnia example, and I love Ann Winnia, she's a wonderful person. There was an example that was a bad one for her where, it was an executive decision that was made with not a lot of debate that may have cost her. She may have lost anyway, I don't know, right? May have cost her that election. That happened to be a very visible example of that. But most candidates that I've worked with are very engaged. I mean, they're the ones that have to put themselves out there. They're the ones that are being followed around. You just hope, I think, as a campaign that you'll have debates about what you do and why and what you say. Because when the candidate says something really, really, really stupid, it's the rest of the people that are trying to clean up after him.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I've not worked on a campaign, and I don't really know a candidate that I've ever interacted with, particularly in Minnesota, where there's a lot of people that are involved in the discussions about how to move forward and what to do. But at the end of the day, it's the candidate's decision. They have to live with themselves. They have to go out there and sell themselves, and they have to be, proud of what's being put up or defend what's being put up. So it's not... Hollywood's version of a candidate who's basically, a toy soldier and wound up and told what to do. It's at all. I mean, I think that's few and far between.
But hopefully if you're the CEO, right, and you may or may not want the candidate to be the CEO, hopefully you pick a good ad team, a good polling team, a good field person to get out the vote. You hire really good people and you listen to those people and take it from there, so to speak.
Yeah.
In the course of Michelle Bachmann's political career, do we have a sense for how often she was actually on message with what her team had laid out in advance and how often she went off the reservation and her team was going, oh, no.
I'm guessing her team was happy with her messages
you think
all
so?
Along the way.
Yeah. Sarah Palin, well, that's actually probably a better example.
I it's a candidate that stood up and says what she believes all the time, whether you agree or not. And a lot of times that's what voters ask for. And in that particular case, that's what you got in the 6th congressional district anyway. So,
right.
There's good and bad on both sides of the aisle. And there are good and bad candidates. But, voters often stand up there and say, stop attacking each other, be positive, and just tell us where you stand on the issues. And sometimes when they do, we look at them and go, why did you just do that? So it's, what do you want?
Right. And when you do say one of those things early on in a campaign, obviously, unfortunately, it can be used against you all the way through. Right. And sometimes they're unrecoverable from, and sometimes they don't make that much difference. But candidates learn in a hurry to think before they speak.
Can we thank our guests tonight, Mike Erlandson and Cullen Sheehan?